Hi, Robin. How are you?
Hi, Carl. Nice to talk to you.
I'm Carl Smith. I'm an economist at University of North Carolina and a blogger at modeledbehavior.com. And I'm here today with Robin Hansen, who is Robin, I'll let you introduce yourself.
I'm an economist at George Mason University, and I blog at Overcoming Bias.
Right. And so we're here to talk about the economics of artificial intelligence in general. I think part of the kicking off of this was the performance of IBM's Watson computer on Jeopardy, and that wowed a lot of people who are not in the artificial intelligence community, so we thought we'd use that as an entree to talk about this. And so I guess the first thing I want to ask you, Robin, is, I mean, did you see Watson play?
Oh, yeah, it's impressive. Cool. Yeah. I mean, you know, obviously since I identify with the tech people who made it, then we won, right?
Right. And my thought on this, and what I really wanted to ask you about, is do you see that as any sort of an important milestone, or is this just like one more?
Sure, it's a great milestone. It's more a milestone in public comprehension and appreciation, but it's also a technical milestone. I think this will inspire people for a long time to try to do similar things, and that's good. It was well earned.
Yeah, I mean, what occurred to me, I think, was two things. One is, you know, the last big IBM challenge against Garry Kasparov in chess was such a narrowly defined range. I mean, and while it was impressive to people, that computers could perform at this level, because the rules of chess are so narrowly prescribed, they gave this impression that computers were only good in a narrow domain. And opening it up to Jeopardy sort of shows, I guess, you know, in my mind, that one, there's this whole different range of things that computers can do. They're unlimited in this. And also, I mean, knocks down another one of the walls that says that there are fundamental things in human intuition that can't be replicated in silicon. So getting puns and jokes and the type of things that are on Jeopardy. And at least if Watson can recognize that's important in showing people what computers can do.
Although the definition of narrow accommodates these things. Right. You know, 10 years ago, a chess looked pretty broad. That looked pretty hard to do. I'm old enough to have been through this cycle many times, and so every time a computer does something really quite beyond what computers had done before, you're tempted to have said, well, before they did narrow things, and now they're showing they can do broad things. But of course, even Watson is really pretty narrow relative to the breadth of human capacity. I think we just really don't intuitively appreciate how powerfully broad human minds are until you try to compete with them.
So you're
lessons of being an AI researcher.
So yeah, so you're still in that this is a fairly narrow application of artificial.
Absolutely.
Well, one of the things that I thought would be interesting to talk about in the larger scale of AI is one of the points that you've made is that for artificial intelligence to make a big difference in the economy, it's got to make a big difference in things that are broad sectors of the economy. And so for us now, that's mainly services. So we think about robots and AI and things that are like manufacturing applications, but we don't do that much manufacturing. We do a lot of services. And so expanding AI to a computer that can respond to human inputs and give answers is seems like one of the core competencies in performing service work. And so that's why I thought it might be an important economic step if we can get computers that can understand natural language.
Well, obviously, a computer that could generically answer pretty much any question you asked it would be a terrifically broad capacity. Something that wins at Jeopardy is not such a thing, and it's not remotely close to such a thing. It's quite impressive, and it's an important milestone, as you said, but it's not that.
So, what do you think the major hurdle is between being able to capture these puns and relate them to something in a database and being a sort of a general question answer machine?
Well, that is the question of artificial intelligence, as you phrased it, which is, why is it so hard?
Right, right.
What is it that human minds can do so well that we find it so hard to copy? And of course, until we finally succeed, we won't really know exactly what it is that humans' minds are so good at. What we do know at a general level is that they're amazingly good at an amazingly wide range of things. And every time we try to write a program to copy one part of it and hope that that will bring us some insight into generality and show us how to do all the rest of it, it picks out one part but then leaves a big vast sea of the rest.
Well, do you think it's reasonable to I don't want to cut you off there.
I was just going to say that I didn't want to necessarily agree with the implication you said that computers haven't made a big difference yet.
Okay.
They have, mm-hmm. but I think one way that an economist would measure the difference that computers make would be the percentage of world income that goes to computers. That's sort of the economist's measure of value,
right. uh-huh.
aggregated over the margin. Of course, it's not considering the inframarginal value, but it's a good overall measure of value. It's the measure by which we say rich countries are rich and poor countries are poor, et cetera.
Right.
And by that measure, computers have carved themselves out a noticeable fraction of world income. I don't know what's up at 1% or perhaps or something like that.
I think it's on that order.
Say again?
I think it's on that order of one
right.
in the 1%.
And so that's quite a triumph. 1% of world income is a lot. It's a hell of a lot of product and value. So we salute it. Absolutely.
I mean,
but
it is. But it's not what people think about, you know, when they say, well, computers are going to change everything. Artificial intelligence is going to change everything. I mean, we're thinking of something, I think, on the scale of the Industrial Revolution for computers, right? You know, where, you know, I guess our current sort of human-based
right.
technologies, you know.
For a while, industry might have captured 1% of world income. That,
right.
that might have been true for many thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
But the Industrial Revolution is when industry captured, you know, more than half of world income.
Exactly. So I think
I guess was more recent, and that was the big difference. So then the question might be, when would computers or things like computers take more than half of world income? And that could still be a long way off, even if they're impressively improving that 1% up to 1.1% or 1.2% or something.
Right, and that's going to make a difference, I think, in how at least we measure our well-being as well, right? So one of the things that excites us about computers is the rapid growth in technological capacity, and if that was hooked up to half of our economy, then half of our economy would be growing that fast. And so, you know, getting, you know, from 1% to, I mean, let's say maybe 50% is a ways off, but, you know, notching up into the higher percentage range has the potential to make an enormous difference for people's lives. And so I think that's, you know, trying to judge, I guess, ahead of time whether or not any of these minor artificial intelligences could help us do that. It's a big deal, right? So, I mean, if we think about applications like, you know, putting natural language operators in medicine or call centers or some of the other areas where we're actually using up a whole bunch of human time and a whole bunch of human resources, it seems like that might be a big deal. I mean, or at least something that people could feel as a change in their life, if the cost of medicine were to actually at some point drop, or if
I don't think anybody's had any trouble waving visions of how computers eventually might help a lot.
Right.
The real question is yes, but when and how hard is it?
Right.
So we come back to your question of what is it so hard about copying humans? And
yeah.
And there are, in a sense, two broad schools of thought, which I can place myself in one of them. One broad school of thought says there's the deep theory of intelligence that we haven't found yet.
Right.
And when we find it, then things will be so much easier.
And, this is
progress has been slow because we haven't found this grand deep theory of intelligence.
Is this what you associated with Elias Yudkowsky and people like that?
Yes, but it's a much more broadly held point of view. It's
right.
pretty common going way, way back. There's just something we're missing, and when we get it, things will be so much easier. And there's another point of view, which is just that it's one damn thing after another. It's just
uh-huh.
a lot of detail, and it's an enormous pile of detail, and you just have to wade your way through it, slowly accumulating the detail, or finding some other clever way to get the detail all at once.
Right.
But if we like saying, what makes a tiger good? Do we have a good theory of tigers or a theory of bacteria or something like that? Why can't we make an artificial bacteria that beats out a regular one? Or an artificial tiger, you know, I guess. And it could just be, well, they have a lot of detail that they're good at, and then you have
right.
to do it all right.
So how would we know, like just thinking about it broadly, I mean, I know that you're sympathetic to the detail theory, and honestly, I probably am too, but how would we know if we were wrong, right? I mean, besides one day somebody coming up with, you know, artificial and general intelligence that they had the insight into and wrote down the magical equation. Is there any evidence along the way that we can point to say?
Well, I think, of course, there's evidence along the way. That is, I think, in fields where powerful theories are likely to be powerful in the future, they have been powerful in the past.
Right.
Physics is a premier example, of course. In physics, we've had a long series of powerful, single powerful theories that give enormous insight and advantage. And that's why we mainly expect to find more of them in the future. And there are other areas such as ecology or running a business or building a bacteria where we haven't seen very much in the way of big powerful theories. And mostly we've seen lots of messy detail, and that would be a reasonable basis on which to project that to be the future. Of course, future never has to be exactly like the past.
So,
it could be that suddenly physics will peter out, and then physics will turn out to be a big mess of details from here on, and the strings theorists are wasting their time because they're never going to find any more big, grand theories. But
so obviously people are chipping away with this, but one thing that makes the intersection probably between artificial intelligence and economics interesting is that in some sense, you know, rational choice theory is an effort to get a theory of how human beings behave, right? And so if you could get some serious insight into how humans behave and how they make choices, then one might guess that that could guide you along. And I think if I understand some of the work that these guys are doing, they're taking sort of that approach, right? They're trying to build like the ultimate utility function, which is sort of underlies a lot of rational economics.
Let's make a more economic analogy, which is to say, you know, what is the secret to being rich? And so in a sense, being rich is like being smart. They are both powerful, important things that are things people really would like to be able to do.
Right.
And the question is, should we be looking for a simple grand mathematical theory of how a country or a company or a person should be rich? And
well, I think a lot of people do, right?
We'll, of course, admit that there are useful insights to be gained from, say, portfolio theory or economic growth theory, things like that. But those theories mainly talk about how to manage a mass of details well, and that, you know, most of what matters is a mass of details. That's our basic main result in economic growth theory and our basic main result in personal portfolio growth theory.
That's sort of true, but if you have sort of, you know, if you have something at the core of how it is that you're going to interact with, you know, this mess of details, maybe you think that the mess of details comes from the environment that either the human or the, you know, AI is set in, right? And if you can say, here's basically what I want you to do with these details, then maybe you reduce the problem to taking the mess of details and translating it down into something that the core function or core set of equations can operate on, and then throwing it back out and just having that process iterate back and forth, back and forth, back and forth as
So again, if we think about economic growth theory, we say, what's the secret to making nations rich? Uh-huh. There are some overall things to say. Uh-huh. There are ways to screw up a nation and make it poor.
Right.
There are ways to mess up the economic engine that would produce growth. Mm-hmm. But our main insights are of the form, here's how not to mess up decent process for collecting lots of detail and embodying them in growth.
Uh-huh.
The main insights in economic growth theory are about where the detail comes from and how to encourage it and how to not get in the way of people trying to innovate and owning some of their innovations and trying to create businesses based on their innovations and reallocating resources geographically, labor-wise, et cetera, to accommodate new innovations and changes. That's where most of our insight in economic growth is basically about how to manage all that detail. So similarly, presumably there are ways to screw up a mind.
Mm-hmm.
There are ways to make the organization of a mind difficult and make it difficult to accumulate knowledge and insight and integrate that with what everything else it knows and build on that in order to create a larger, more capable system. But again, the analogy with economic growth, if that was the apt analogy, would suggest that mainly it's how not to get in the way.
Right. So that sort of pours a little bit of cold water on the idea that maybe we'll find the magical equations of intelligence. But I think, you know, so you're famous for the notion of porting intelligence from human beings over to computers. But at least in my sense, maybe there's an area that would match in between that, and that would be, could you sufficiently model the interactions of neurons, and say a neuron is a basic element, and then sort of grow your own artificial intelligence. So if I understand basically how neurons interact with one another, and I can model a single neuron, then I can just pile a bunch of them onto each other, and because of the nature of neuron reactions, they'll sort of build a brain in and of themselves. Is that something that sounds at all reasonable to you?
I'm not sure exactly what you have in mind. It sounds like you have in mind the more, you know, grow it up from a baby and have it learn everything itself.
Something like that. I mean, maybe you don't
let's make again the analogy, because I think, again, the analogy economic growth works well. You could also make an analogy to biological ecosystems, but the economic growth is more you're in my area of expertise. Uh-huh. There are several different ways to make a country rich. One way to make a country rich is to just have it participate in the world economy and continue to accumulate insight and figure out how it can fit into the world economy and grow that way. That would be approach number one to making a country rich. Approach number two to making a country rich might be to close down all the borders and then try really hard to have a good growth engine inside the company. So you reward innovation well and you develop, you know, good intellectual property and everything else inside the country, and you close all the borders and you just try to grow really fast compared to the rest of the world.
Okay.
That might have been, say, the old Soviet Union approach.
Uh-huh.
And a third approach might be to, say, if you're a poor country, the way to be rich is just to move all your people to a rich country.
Exactly.
And have them take advantage of the wealth of the rich country.
Uh-huh.
So I think these three approaches have analogs in different approaches to artificial intelligence.
Right. So in this case,
continuing to write the code and just collect the code is the approach that's analogous to just continuing to be part of the world economy and doing the best you can. The great growth or grow it up from a baby scenario is this close off the borders and really figure out how to run a country well inside your country scenario. And the move everybody to a rich country scenario is more the upload or whole brain emulation approach of saying there's already this big, rich, integrated set of mind stuff, and let's just try to find a way to port it and import it from where it already is to somewhere more useful.
Yeah. So why don't we, since this is something that that obviously you've done a lot of work with, why don't we for the people here talk a little bit more about this whole brain emulation stuff? And I'll see if I can, you know, you can go, and I'll see if I can break in and break it down for people if it gets a little bit too heady.
I'll try to keep it very simple.
Okay.
The idea is that what makes you capable as a mind is your head. In particular, the things your head is made out of are a bunch of cells that send signals to each other. And each cell has some internal process by which it takes outside signals and converts them into some change of internal state and then sends new signals out based on that. And there's an enormous number of cells in your brain. But the hope is that there are not as enormous a number of types of cells in your brain. And so that if we can figure out how each type of cell works in the sense of how does it take signals from the outside, its internal state, change its state, and send new signals out, if we can manage to, say, find only a few thousand such types of neurons or cells and get each one mapped as a process, then we can scan a real brain, cell for cell, identify in the scan what type of cell it is and what's its internal state, and then make a computer simulation of the whole thing where we use models of how each cell works to model the cells, and we use the entire arrangement of how things are connected to make the whole simulation. And then if we've done a decent enough job with the parts, they don't have to be exactly right, they just have to be close enough, then this whole system will have an input-output behavior comparable to the mind you scanned in the first place. And if that was a human, then it would have the full range of breadth of human capacities that the human had.
Right. So I think at its core, we're basically saying if we build a computer simulation of a brain that is accurate enough, it's going to act just like a brain, and it's basically going to be able to do everything that a brain does. And I, where, right. there are a couple places where you often get pushback, or where this idea often gets pushed back. And one is where you say, you know, if we're, you know, we don't have to get it exactly right, right? And I think some people would say, well, that doesn't make sense to me, right? The brain is really, you know, an amazing detail, amazingly complicated thing. You know, all these parts are interacting. And here you're saying that, you know, well, if I get some rough idea of how a neuron works, which is sort of, you know, your basic brain cell, and then I get some rough idea about how all these neurons are connected, then I just build up a program that has my rough neuron connected roughly to all the other neurons, and then I get, you know, a rough brain. And, you know, the sense I think a lot of people has that you're just going to get a bunch of mush if you try that.
Right. So the question is, how close do you need to be?
Right.
So physically, we should be able to get pretty close in terms of the connections, because the connections are sort of things we'll scan. We can get moderately close in terms of the cells. The basic insight is that the brain is a signal processing system. It was designed by evolution to be a signal processing system, and signaling processing systems in general are designed to be sensitive to certain inputs and insensitive to others. Otherwise, they just don't work. So the computer you and I are talking on, or your telephone, or almost any, your thermostat even, they are designed to be sensitive to some things and not sensitive to others. So that's the reason to expect these systems not to be sensitive to every little detail that's in the brain, because otherwise they wouldn't work. We know that brains function quite reasonably well with large disturbances. You can whack them
that's
on the
exactly
side.
Right.
You can stick big piles of strange chemicals inside, not just random chemicals, but chemicals that actually are the chemicals they use to talk to each other with.
Yeah, and I mean, we have some examples of people having spikes driven through their brain, enormous, you know, huge, massive disruptions to brain tissue, and still being able to function, you know, extreme encephalitis and still being able to function. So, yeah, we do have examples of messing up the brain in pretty clear, obvious ways, and it's still managing to hang in there. So I guess
at least in the short run.
At least in the short run, right. So
right.
I want to stop just for a second and tell people. So we're saying that one path to artificial intelligence is to build up this giant simulation of a person. And to connect that back to what we're talking about before, the idea here is, you know, like Robin said, computers are maybe responsible for 1.5% of economic innovation. We'd like to bump that up, or we wouldn't like to, but we envision a world in which that could be bumped up. And we're asking ourselves how that could happen, right? And it can happen if computers are able to do lots of the types of things that people do, because people are sort of the basis of all economies, people interacting with one another. And so long as computers can't do the types of things that people can do, computers are going to be fundamentally limited in their role in the economy. And so how might computers be able to do the things they can do? One is you could keep going the Watson route and see if you can program a computer that can understand people. The other, and I think this is what we're getting to, is can you just say, look, we're not really going to understand this, or maybe not understand it anytime soon, but we can copy it. And so we're just going to copy the brain into the simulation. That's sort of the motivation behind this. And one of the things that Robin and Sons think a lot about, so what would happen if we were able to do that? So why don't you give a brief sketch of your vision of the world?
I want to first just cut off any misunderstandings here. So one is, for example, I don't think the whole brain emulation is at all easy.
Right.
And I don't think it's happening in the next 10 or even 20 years.
Right.
I'd say, you know, sometime roughly within a century or so seems a more likely time frame for this to be feasible. It's an enormous amount of work. It's an enormous difficult problem, but it's a feasible problem. It's the sort of problem that we could solve.
And it's a problem that we can work. Because it's a problem that we can break down into its constituent parts, right? So, I mean, it's not just like we're sitting here saying whole brain emulations, that seems kind of hard, maybe give it a century. I mean, we can think about the types of things that we need to do to make this happen, you know? And so, you know, I think people have thought about that, right? So what's it going to take to scan a brain well enough? And my sense is that that's where there's the most hope, right, is in some of the scanning technology. Is that match with what you're saying?
There are three technologies required here.
Okay.
And so projecting when this might happen is based on projecting the three required technologies. One is that you have to, as you say, scan a brain. And that's actually the technology that seems on track to be ready first.
Right.
We've actually scanned entire mouse brains. at a reasonable resolution. We don't know how much resolution will really be required until we have the good cell models, and that's another technology that's required, the cell modeling technology. We have to model basically all the relevant cell types. And the third technology required is the computers.
Right.
The computers are on track to probably be ready mid-century, if not sooner, depending on how much cell detail is required. Again, but that goes back to needing the cell models. So the cell modeling is the thing that's the most uncertain in terms of projecting the time. And how this actually plays out economically does depend, importantly, on which of these technologies is the last one to be ready.
Right. And let me just say, so we have, basically, we have a map of a mouse brain. So we know how all these different parts are connected, right? And I think, you know, so that's the number one scanning technology. So, and just for people to be confused, so sometimes you get the impression that when we're scanning the brain, we're going to draw some laser light over the head and get extract a bunch of information. It's quite a bit messier than that. So, yeah.
Well,
so,
it's very mechanical. You just slice a thin layer, and then you take a picture of that thin layer, and then you slice another thin layer, and you basically take a picture of the next layer, and at the end, you don't have the mouse brain left. You just have lots of little slices.
So that's important to know for also for people who might wonder when they're going to get their brain scanned. It's going to be something that probably you're going to want to hold off on until at least you run out.
Well, we can talk more about that once we talk about what's going to happen.
Okay. Okay. So go ahead and go down the line of you were saying the three technologies, and it matters which one comes last.
For the transition. Now, I guess the simplest things to talk about would be robust predictions that seem to be reliable regardless of the details of how exactly this plays out.
Right.
And so as economists, I think we should focus first on the most robust predictions. And to clarify, as you well know at least, but maybe not some of our listeners, a standard way in which economists analyze an economic event or transition or effect is to imagine roughly a free market supply and demand equilibrium,
right,
and try to calculate effects within that equilibrium. And then given those results, you can start to consider whether some sorts of regulations or interventions would be advisable or useful, etc. But our first tool of analysis, because it's our best tool, is supply and demand.
Right. Supply. We always reduce supply and demand. So.
Right. So clearly here, the first thing to realize is that once you actually have a bunch of boxes that can substitute for humans wholesale, that is not do absolutely everything they do just the way they do it, but give a reasonable substitute at a cheaper price, labor economics says employers will buy them or hire them or rent them, however you want to think about it, and they will suddenly take the large chunk of world labor income will be going to these substitutes. That would be a pretty robust prediction about being able to make these boxes cheaply, if they in fact have this broad capacity.
So our core thing here that makes this prediction go is that it's going to be cheaper to build a new box with a human-level mind in it than to build a new human. I mean, I think that's
At some level, we're defining the event to be that.
Exactly.
So you could imagine the technology appears, but it's not cheap enough yet to be widely fielded this way.
Uh-huh.
And then I would think of that as precursor or the early stage before the big event really happened. Just as industry was possible well before the Industrial Revolution.
Right.
Industry happened and existed, but we don't call that the Industrial Revolution. Industrial Revolution is when industry could en masse displace farming.
Right.
The economy.
So our event is that we've got these boxes. We've done this thing. We've mapped out how human brains work. We have created a simulation that runs good enough to respond like a person. And so that means if you hook it up to something, it can talk to you. It can generate ideas. It can manipulate machines just as well as a person can. And we can make these boxes pretty cheaply. So in essence, we can pop out human level intelligence pretty cheaply. So go ahead.
Right. So the obvious labor economics implications, first of all, is that human wages fall to match the price of these things. So if humans don't have other sources of income other than their ability to earn wages, then their source of income is drastically decreased. But of course, in this economy, there's a vast increase in total wealth.
Right.
And that total wealth is owned by somebody. It's owned by whoever made the machines, owns the machines, owns rents things to the machines, owns resources that are useful to the machines, etc. All those resources now are vastly more valuable. So if the humans owned any small fraction of those resources, then they could be rich.
Right. And so I think that's one of the two things that are a big deal for people. One is saying as soon as artificial intelligence comes along that's about as smart as you, then I think in most people's perception of the world we're going to say that they're more or less out of work. Now as economists we don't think that way. We think more on the margin. So we're going to say the wage for most of the things that you do is going to go way down. And that's going to mean for a lot of people that either they're going to be living on subsistence level or maybe even below, and we can talk about what that might mean, or you're going to stop working. Right? It's just not going to be worth it for you to work. You're going to live off of some other wealth that you have. And I think we envision that will be a large fraction of the human population is going to live off of the existing wealth that they have because they're going to become so much richer, right? And we're going to become so much richer because we have this massive increase in the number of workers out there. They're going to be producing more stuff. And so the companies that they work for or the machines that they use or the land that they exist on is going to become incredibly valuable, just the way that whenever you have many people flood into a city like New York City, the land that's there and the buildings that's there and everything that's there becomes incredibly valuable as you have all these new workers flooding
in. So that prediction is elaborated by thinking about changes in growth rates. So another pretty robust prediction here, I think, is that the growth rate in the economy will drastically increase. Right. So you hinted that at that by saying that Moore's Law sort of makes computer-related technologies improve faster today than other technologies. And here, if most of the labor economy is based on something like computers, then they could also be improving with something like Moore's Law in terms of their capacities. But in addition to that effect, even setting that effect aside, in current growth theory, the growth rate of our economy is limited by the fact that although we can make capital quickly, we can't make labor quickly. And so capital quickly reaches diminishing returns relative to labor. And the growth rate of the economy is limited by how fast we can increase the pool of skilled labor. And in this alternative economy, you can create labor as quickly as you can create capital. And that by itself can make a dramatic increase in growth rates. So putting all these together, the growth of the economy could be doubling not every 15 years as it does now, but maybe every year or every month or week or faster. That means that if you have a small amount of wealth and the economy doubles every month, then your wealth will double every month if you save it. And so even if it's not very much the first month, in a couple months, it'll be plenty.
Right. And that's actually something that I wanted to push back about a little. I'm a little concerned that people might have a hard time following. But so economists generally think that, you know, more or less, you know, there are a bunch of complicated things going on in the economy, as we always said, but more or less what it boils down to is you have some machines, we call that capital, you have some people, we call that labor, you mix them together, you get stuff, that's economic production. Well, you know, what determines how much stuff you can make? Well, it turns out that we can make more machines, so we can use our economy to build more machines, which then feeds back and gives us a stronger economy. And you might think that this process could just race off faster and faster. We build more machines, that allows us to build even more machines, allows us to build even more machines. But it's limited because we don't build more and more people. And so we have a bunch of machines now, but we don't have enough people to operate them. Or it's less efficient. And so we're fundamentally limited by the amount of people that we have, the amount of workers that we have. But if we have this box that works just like a worker, then that limitation goes away. So the economy is no longer fundamentally limited, and it can just race off into the future, perhaps limited by things that we don't quite see yet, or, you know, we have a hard time getting a handle on. Maybe there'll be some key natural resource that becomes limited, that it becomes scarce, and we can't keep expanding because we don't have enough of this natural resource. But our main thing that's limiting us now is going to go away. And so we expect the economy to race off. Where I wanted to push back, though, is you were saying, okay, if you just save, right? Well, that's fine. And, you know, I've tried to think about this a little bit. But what if the boxes are also saving, right? So your return from saving is not just going to be sort of, you know, okay, we save some money, the economy grows, and so I'm wealthier. But it's going to be what economists think of as the marginal difference, right? So how much better is the world because I did some additional saving? And I'm out here saving, but, you know, these boxes apparently act like people, live like people, do things like people, and one of the things they might do is save. And so if they're flooding the market with a bunch of savings, then my small addition might not make that much difference. Is that how does your growth model deal with that?
I mean, standard, you know, growth theory models predict that savings rates don't deviate very far from growth rates. Now, obviously, interest rates are the equilibrium of a supply and a demand for investment, and there are, in principle, a great many things that can influence both the supply and the demand for investment. Uh-huh. And so that price, in principle, can depend with all those things. So the exact interest rate can't be predicted until you know all the different determinants of the supply and demand for investment. But as a rough overall rule, given the magnitudes we're talking about, it's pretty hard to see how, if the economy was doubling every month, that interest rates wouldn't be somewhere in the ballpark of doubling every month.
Right.
Because that's, it is the, again, the opportunity cost of resources would be huge if the economy is doubling every month. A month from now, something is not worth nearly as much as it was a month before.
Uh-huh.
And so that has to be reflected in the interest rates as part of the equilibrium of the opportunity cost of not using up resources now, waiting a month to use it later.
Right.
And again, so, it's just a pretty robust prediction of standard growth theory.
I think that's right. I'm just trying to see if we can work through how the intuition works with everything that people know about savings and how you think about savings and stuff. And if you're saying that, well, look, you have all these boxes, and one of the things, I mean, I think this is the way I've tried to talk about it too, is they're innovating, they're coming up with new ideas. Again, they can do everything that a person can do because we just basically simulated a person. And so one of the things that they're doing is coming up with new ways to use old stuff. And so even just if we think about saving, not even in the sort of standard capital market sense, like you go and you put some money in the bank account and you do it, but just savings is in not using something up. If you have, you know, even physical goods, wood, you know, the stuff that's in your house, that you have these potentially millions, trillions of boxes coming around thinking up new ways to use your old stuff, and every week or so, some box out there is going to think of a fantastically new way to be able to use something you've got, and will, if you give it to them, will be able to produce something extraordinary with it. I think that sounds a little crazy in sci-fi, but comes pretty much out of the basic growth models that we have. That
so
this is what this
I think
is what
it's.
Happened.
I think it's worth commenting on the property rights arrangements here.
Yeah.
And so, I think people might not appreciate that the kind of predictions that we're making here about falling wages and increasing growth rates are relatively robust to the property rights arrangement details.
Uh-huh.
Not that they won't depend on the details, but exactly. But it these predictions follow regardless of whether, say, these boxes are owned and slaves of something
right.
else,
exactly,
or whether they are completely autonomous things that own themselves but somehow had to sort of borrow resources to exist in the first place and then pay those loans off in order to continue existing, or even, you know, the result of altruistic creation by previous ancestors of them, you'd still get these huge growth rates, the vastly falling wages, and these sorts of predictions. Obviously, many people care about what sort of property rights arrangements would happen, and I can't say that I'm indifferent to it either. It's just, as an economist, we distinguish which things make a difference for which predictions.
Right. And so basically, however you slice it and dice it, if you get a bunch of these things being created, whether they're created as slaves or whether they're created, you know, through some sort of free choice arrangement between the person who, you know, thought them up, or whether they're created by some group who just wants to expand the total number of sentient beings in the world, if you get a bunch of these workers, the economic growth arguments, the labor market arguments are just going to fall out. And I think, moreover, you've made the point that unless you can somehow stop every single person in the world from trying to create a bunch of these workers, somebody's going to do it, right? Somebody's going to get the idea that we should be making a lot of these boxes, either for fun or profit. and right. and then the whole thing breaks open. So it's really a hard thing. Once you go down this road of, you know, making computers or making some sort of box that can do everything a person can do, it's really hard to stop these sort of things from happening. Even though they seem fantastic and seem amazing, it's hard to stop it because the technology to reproduce is so simple that wherever it gets started, it's just going to take off and that's going to dominate the rest of the world. So even if it's just one guy who, you know, the whole world decides, you know, nah, we don't want to get involved in this. This is a little bit too creepy. But one guy off, you know, somewhere decides, no, I'm going to do this. I'm going to make these boxes. It just so turns out that these boxes coming from him flood the world. They take over the world and they're, you know, sort of the most of the sentient beings in the world are descended from them. Oh, go ahead if you want to correct something on that.
Economists are not at all averse to considering possible regulation and taxation right. and intervention to change outcomes. But we do need to be and are usually aware that our capacity is limited.
Right, exactly.
You know, changes to what would be otherwise the free market outcome require enforcement. They require monitoring. And usually one is limited in how far one can push away from what would be the equilibrium because you get more and more stronger pressures for black market exactly. attempts to get around it. So the size of the effects we are talking about here are so vastly enormous that you're going to be somewhere in this range. You may care a lot about where exactly you are, and then that may be the right thing to do is to change and regulate and tax in order to adjust to be one place versus another. But you're not really going to change whether you're in this ballpark or not. That's
right.
something you have to accept.
Yeah, and so the forces, you know, our argument, yeah, the forces that are here to change the world are so strong that there's probably not a whole lot we can do to keep this from happening. Now, I think that sort of segues, and maybe there's something you want to talk about before that, but is this, a lot of people have expressed sort of concern about, like, would this even be a world that we want? So we're talking about, you know, lots of boxes coming into existence. We're talking about driving wages way down. And I think the thing that may not have been immediately clear is that then all of these boxes, all of these sort of artificial intelligence that we have working for us, doing all these things, they're going to wind up being pretty poor on average. They weren't going to wind up living a pretty subsistence level life. I mean, that's what comes out of our equations, right?
Right. So first of all, you have to start thinking about things from the box's point of view. And, of course, mm-hmm. presumably they will have appearances that are more aesthetically pleasing to themselves and us than box, but we're just using the box as a crude descriptor here.
Right. They could all be made to look like Julie Henderson. We want.
Right, for example,
yeah.
To pick a random person in the world. these boxes will have been a copy of a person recently, and whatever changes we are able to make to them, they will be roughly human in terms of their psychology and mental style. And so they will have the usual sorts of human urges and desires. They will be willing to work, but not maybe all the time, and they will want some leisure, and they will like to have some video games and virtual reality parties and do some travel sometimes, things like that. But the economics here says that they are, the median one is certainly very poor relative to us in the sense that if we owned their income, we couldn't survive. We simply would die. But of course, their bodies are cheaper to produce and make, so subsistence.
Let's make that point clear. Why is it they're going to be so cheap relative to us? So, you know, our prediction is that they're going to be even poorer than, you know, sort of the Dickens level characters were. And,
or vastly. I mean, it could be that, for example, their income is $1 a year.
Right.
Because that's all it takes to support this. The point was that the income will fall to roughly the cost of creating one of these things. So
exactly.
the price to rent one would set the bound of the basic income. Of course, specially trained ones could get incomes higher than that to compensate for the cost of training. And so they might get an income of $3 a year, $2 of which goes to pay the cost of the training of, you know, a billion of them, say, at a cost of $2 billion, say, something like that.
But I think for the listeners, the fundamental thing is because they're artificial, because they can be created, you know, they will be created until the what you get out, the sort of benefit of creating them, which is sort of their wage, what they can produce, is lower or is at the cost of creating. Those two things are where it's going to match. And that's the basic economic intuition, and we think that, you know, that's worked out since we've been looking at the economy, and no matter how you slice it, that's probably going to happen. And so their artificial nature is going to drive all of their wages down to exactly what we need to maintain them.
So, or roughly in that ballpark.
Now, roughly in that ballpark.
Subsistence for these robots would be different than human subsistence. If you think about what would be horrible about a human subsistence life, well, a lot of it has to do with when things go really badly. So it's not such a terrible thing to be a subsistence level farmer, except when there's a famine or a pandemic or a war. Then you have very little to, you know, to support yourself in such circumstances. It can be really bad. These creatures can exist in a much more stable environment where they don't have to worry much about famines or pandemics or things like that. And so they could just, you know, go to work every day and do their job and come home and enjoy virtual reality for a couple hours before they go to sleep. And they're not rich, but they're not miserable necessarily either.
And so I think that's a point where that's hard for people to get around. So we're creating these, you want to call them boxes, robots. If they look like people, we could call them androids, although they probably won't,
right.
But we don't need to get in that. But so we've got these creatures with feelings. We presume they have feelings because they're copied just from us. And one of the things that you've contended, Robin, is that even very poor people have, you know, we shouldn't worry about their quality of life. It's still going to be good. And I think that's something that needs to be defended. So we usually think that one of our major successes in the last 150 years or so is raising the living standards of much of the world above subsistence. And here you are saying that we're going to bring in all of these, you know, artificial intelligences that have our feelings, have our emotions, have all the things like us, and they're going to live at subsistence, but it's going to be okay. And so it seems like you're advocating undoing all of the progress of human development, or at least maybe not advocating, but saying that it'll be all right.
Right. So, I mean, the first thing to notice is just your mind, your personality, your mental style was evolved for creatures who lived at subsistence. I mean, subsistence was the median existence until a few hundred years ago, and even until 100 years ago, almost. So people were adapted and made for this sort of environment. And if you, you know, see people who live like that and you go meet them and talk to them, they are recognizably human. They laugh, they smile, they party.
I mean, they do, but most of them say that, you know, they would prefer higher incomes, and usually
I'd like to be ten times as rich as I am.
When we create a situation where incomes rise for the poorest people, we pat ourselves on the back and talk about what a great job we did. So why is it not then a bad thing to have a bunch of people who are living at subsistence level? You know, I mean, we understand that they're human, or that, you know, I know that a lot of people are going to reject that they're human, but, you know, we understand that they have human-like experiences, and that's going to include some moments of joy and some moments of sadness. But it's also probably going to include a lot of moments of wishing that things were, you know, that they were wealthier than they were, right? Or no, you don't think they will?
I'm sure poor people will have moments where they wish they were rich.
Right.
We all do. Us ugly people have moments we wish we were handsome and pretty. And envy is universally human, and I expect these boxes would maintain it. But the question is, what are the alternatives? What are the choices? If you imagine holding constant the people and saying, wouldn't it be better if they were richer? Well, of course, that would be better, holding constant the people, that they should be richer. But if you ask the question, should we prevent the existence of people who would be poor, that's a different choice. The alternative there is not existing, not being richer. So if by some heroic measure we had enormous labor regulations on preventing the creation of these boxes to maintain higher wages, maybe we could keep the wages, you know, maybe 10 times subsistence level, 100 times subsistence level. It would still be vastly smaller than human subsistence level, but that might be possible. But you would be preventing then the existence of much more of them who could and would enjoy their lives, but at a lower income level.
Okay, but so we basically have, you know, through the combination of raw technology and culture, a system that did this in the Western world, the demographic transition, people having fewer and fewer kids. You know, maybe they thought of it as spreading their wealth among fewer kids. Maybe the opportunity cost or basically what they had to give up to have kids was higher. You know, we're not exactly sure. But certainly the fact is that people stopped, or people had fewer and fewer children, and thus their children wound up being wealthier and wealthier. And again, most people thought of that as a good thing, right? So, and it is true. I mean, you know, so if we had fertility rates that were much, much higher, there would be many, many more people in the world. Those people would be poor, likely.
Right.
But most families don't think of that as a good thing. Like, I should have as many children as possible, no matter how poor that makes my family, no matter how little attention I can give to each one of my children, no matter how little higher education I can support to my children, well, I should just keep having more so that
so
I think bring
the
new soul.
The Industrial Revolution would have happened, and we would be richer even without the demographic transition. We would counterfactually have more people who are poor, but they would still be rich relative to farmers of a few hundred years ago. So I don't want to give the demographic transition credit for us being rich.
Right. But still,
there's the cultural impression, as you say, that individuals tend to think they would like their children to be fewer and richer than many and poorer. Mm-hmm. I think that the source of the demographic transition is one of the major mysteries of today, and I have some speculation, but I think it's a central thing to understand. I think that, in fact, that intuition's wrong in the sense that it is better to have more poor people than a fewer rich people. But I also think that that altruistic calculation isn't the dominating thing in choosing how many children. I think more often it's a choice of my status versus having more children. And people choose to live lives where they have high status and enjoy their lives rather than devoting more energy to their children because that seems to lower their status. It wasn't true long ago necessarily that devoting your energy to more children brought you lower status, but in today's world it seems to be that way. I also think there's a way in which people try to show concern about poor people by wringing their hands and saying, isn't it terrible, 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 terrible that they're poor, as if a way to express that some sort of sympathy for them, and the idea that you could say poor would be better if they were rich, but they're all right, seems to be equated with not caring about the poor and not sympathizing with their lives.
Well, let's just get on the record the extreme nature of what you're saying here. I mean, obviously I'm extremely sympathetic, but for most people that you're saying, okay, it might be the case that most Western parents think that by having, you know, one, two, three children, I'll be able to devote all this quality time to my children. I'll be able to, you know, help them get into the best schools that they can get into and have the best shot at life. And that I'm doing this because I care about my children's future. And you're saying, I'm not really so sure about that. I don't even think that that's the values that people have. It's really based on whether or not having a bunch of children makes you look good in the eyes of other parents, right?
Other people. There's the huge effect of choosing whether to have a child at all. There are many people who have no children.
Right.
And clearly having no child is not being driven by wanting to have fewer, more quality children.
Okay.
And a lot of people choose to have no children. And in fact, the motives that produce people to choose to have no children seem to me pretty similar to the motives that induce people to have, say, one and not two children, or two and not three children. I don't see a huge difference between those different marginal choices. You know, again, if the choice between zero and one was just an enormously different kind of choice based on enormously different considerations with different sorts of correlates than the choice between one and two or two and three, then it would be more plausible that it was focused on the average quality of the children. But again, zero is a really quite distinct choice if under that theory.
Right. And so just what you're saying is basically that if you don't have any kids at all, you can't be really doing that because you want to give your kids a better shot since you have none. And the people who say, I don't want to have any kids at all, seem to be making roughly the same choice as the people who say, I want to have one kid. Or at least the things that influence and the things that push them in one direction or the other are pretty much the same. And, when we go out, and I think they're big issues and they should be talked about and get this thing, but the sense of what's sort of at issue when we talk about how good would a world with, you know, potentially reproducible sentient beings be, we have to be willing, I think, to question an enormous amount of the intuition we have about the world that we're living in now. And so what we think we're telling ourselves about our choice to have children is one. Another one you're saying is what we think we're telling ourselves about how we care about the poor, that, you know, we're really, you know, getting upset about the living conditions of the poor, because if we didn't, then it would make us seem or feel or tell us that we didn't care at all. Is that an accurate assumption of what you're saying?
I don't know how much time we have left. I wanted to make sure we came back to the point we mentioned earlier about how it matters which of the three technologies is the last one to be ready.
I think officially we have like 5 minutes. I have a complete willingness to go over. I don't know how the folks.
Okay, well, they can edit, I suppose.
Yeah. So go for it.
Just because we brought it up again, the smoothest transition would be if computers were the things ready last.
Right.
Because then you'd have had these very expensive versions of the boxes that you could have created, and you could try them out with the expensive versions of the boxes, and people could see and feel what they were like, and then you could see computer costs slowly falling until the point where they were ready to go live and spread out everyone, and people could anticipate that event and prepare for it, and then there'd be a wide competition to be able to be the people who take advantage of that first transition. Lots of people can make computers and use computers, and then it would be a very competitive, broad-based sort of transition and anticipated. If scanning was the last technology to be ready, then you would have everything ready except you couldn't make scans very cheap, and then you'd be creating big consortiums to get together to make one big scan so that they could then divide the profits from making trillions of copies of this first scan. And that would be a more centralized transition, because there would be this one consortium that sort of owned it and ruled and basically owned the new world because it could afford this first scan.
Now that's assuming that some of the property rights are structured to give all the income back to the creators of the artificial intelligence.
Right? Well, it would depend on, obviously, their ability to own these new things they create. But presumably they would try very hard to do that and put lots of security attempts in, because that would be worth trillions of dollars to them, many trillions. The third scenario of the transition is where the scanning is ready and the computers are ready, but the models are not ready. And now this is more of a scenario where people don't necessarily believe the thing's even going to happen, or it's even possible, because until they actually have a working example, they don't necessarily believe it works.
Right.
And it's also not very much harder to predict when exactly it would happen. Maybe there'd be some last insight that lets you model the last, 300 types of cells, whereas you thought it might take you another four decades or something. Mm-hmm. And so it would be a very disruptive, unanticipated transition. And then whoever did the last modeling, they might be able to get property rights or some advantage from being a centralized actor there, and it might also be a more centralized transition. If I had my druthers, I'd rather it was the computers that were ready last. But that requires that we have a rapid development on the cell modeling, and that would be possible in the sense that the cell modeling is a really small amount of effort at the moment, and it would be a small amount of money would be enough to vastly increase the rate at which we do that. But I don't have the money personally.
So it seems to me, to get to this thing, the key issue with the computers coming last is that you're going to have more people who are able to do this, more different sort of people who are going to be able to be copied. Unless you just have an attachment to yourself being copied, though, is that really important? I mean, does that matter?
The issue of whether this transition is competitive overall in terms of not being run by one country or one ethnicity or one group, that's a somewhat separate issue from, in this new world, in terms of the distribution of copies of original humans, how concentrated is that distribution of copies? But yes, they're related in the sense that if there's this one big scan, and then you finally finish the scan and then you make lots of copies of the scan, then presumably a large fraction of this new world will be copies of this one first human who was scanned.
Right.
In this one vast, expensive scan.
And so it seems that the scanning coming last and having one person worries you, but uh, it, you know, I mean, I guess it depends on how naturally.
Well, it's not just the inequality in the people; it's also the inequality in the organizations that, right. that manage to do it. That is, you can imagine competing consortiums, and then one of them finally wins, and then there's a big disruption because it's Indonesia that wins, or you know, something. Who knows, right?
Right.
And then there's a lot of military uncertainty and concern, and you can just imagine all sorts of things going wrong with that sort of so much at stake in such a competition.
So it's just that the transition is messier. I mean, we get to the
right,
same place
exactly.
ultimately, except for, you know, we might, in one scenario, we might have a bunch of boxes which are all copies of the same person. In another, we
right.
might have multiple different people. But the thing, and I don't know what your thoughts were on this, is there any interest, do you think it's worth thinking about who's copied and should there be any control in that? I mean, even within, you know, the people that we have, right, it seems like there are very obvious distinctions of people you might not want to be copied. I mean, someone who is extremely violent, right? I mean, you don't want to make a bunch of copies of, you know, Kim Jong-il if, you know, Korea were somehow to be ahead on the scanning technology. But, you know, you might feel that, you know, having certain copies of people with, you know, extremely good musical talent or other talents might even be a really good thing. And
now, in a world where we set aside the one big scan world, in a world where something else is the limiting factor, then
right.
what sort of creatures are in this new world will be a combination of two effects: who's willing to pay to scan who,
uh-huh.
and who ends up being most competitive and productive in this new world.
Right.
Now, at a very basic level, I think there's no way of escaping the scenario where there's an enormous inequality and mismatch between the 6 billion of us. And whoever ends up being dominant in this new world. Even if all 6 billion of us were scanned all at the same time, we're just not going to be equally productive in this new world, and there's just much more leverage for making more copies of the ones that are more productive in this world.
Right.
So there's simply going to be a vast inequality of influence from us to them. Secondly, of course, it does cost money to scan, so then we expect there to be profit-oriented people thinking about who would be a good person to invest in scanning so that they could get some of the returns from those people being productive. So then you'll have a selection with an eye to that productivity
right.
initially. You'll also have just some people thinking, well, I want to pay for myself because I believe in myself even if nobody else does.
Uh-huh.
But both of those effects, I think, will favor current elites. So
right. Exactly.
It seems hard to escape the scenario that the people who are the most elite in our world, that is perceived to be the most productive and which is highly correlated with get paid a lot, this process would highly select preferentially from those groups. So in fact, they will be, you know, the new world that our elites populate. Now, some of us will get there too. But in a sense, you could say there's a delicious comeuppance because now they live at subsistence wages where they were billionaires before. Nevertheless, you know, most of world income is going to trillions of copies of what were once billionaires, and now we're making a dollar a year or something.
So huge downward mobility, which I think is interesting. We probably don't have time to explore this, but you know, the way that feeds some into Greg Clark's sort of hypothesis on the Industrial Revolution, so, you know, that at least a factor in it was huge downward mobility. And one thing I've wondered is if you have these great changes where some people are going to benefit enormously, and one of the things that people like to do is make copies of themselves. We're driven by evolution to do that through natural means. And it seems that people, you know, for reasons that sometimes baffle me, are very interested in making copies of themselves if this emulation technology came along. I'm not certain that I would want lots of copies of me going around living a subsistence life, but you know, a lot of people seem interested in that. But those two things are maybe somehow fundamentally connected. This is disruptive technology. Some people who are in a lucky position get to make a bunch of copies of themselves and then dominate the next wave of humanity. Anyway, we should probably think about, we're past the hour mark, we should probably think about how to wrap this up. So I guess, you know, what are our takeaways? So, you know, Watson, I think, is what got a lot of people interested in this technology, this idea. You know, it has some potential to take on some service jobs, but it's not really sort of the big thing that we see changing humans' relationship with artificial intelligence. It's likely going to be something more general. It could come about because people figure out what the magical equations are, But both Robin and I think that it's more likely to come about from mapping existing people and then copying them, seeing as how that way you don't really have to know what you're doing. You just have to be able to do it carefully enough. And is that a fair summary of what you think?
Right. And then, I mean, I think one thing you and I should pat ourselves on the back with at some level is this idea that economists have interesting and useful things to say about such scenarios.
Right.
Usually such scenarios are elaborated by technologists or science fiction writers or something like that with other agendas and also other areas of expertise. I think it would be useful for us to identify how this looks different to us as economists and why people should take that seriously, because economists know a lot.
Right. I mean, that's always true. They should always take us more seriously. But I think,
But what specifically? How is it that you and I specifically come at this differently than a random computer scientist or something because we have this economics insight?
Are you asking me that, or is this rhetorical?
Yes, I'm asking. So one of my suggestions is the idea that growth and overall value and productivity is a mass of little details in the economy.
Right.
And that makes that more plausible as a model of the mind as well, that the mind is capable because it manages a mass of details well. The idea that innovation and growth tends to be just lots of little innovations and growth and not a few big, vast changes.
I'm a little bit less comfortable with porting that intuition, that maybe because I wasn't in, because I didn't spend a lot of time in the hard sciences. And yes, that's my natural sort of inclination or way to think about it. But I wonder, you know, how much of that is based off of the sort of discipline that I grew up in versus my discipline just being that awesome. But where I do definitely feel like people should be open to the economics point of view is, what is the world going to look like when this happens? And that's something that, I mean, that when we think about how people go about their daily lives, economics is sort of, you know, sometimes at the science of daily life, right? So, you know, what determines what you're able to buy, what you're able to do, the opportunities that you have, all those things are economic issues. And when we think about how is technology going to affect the future, what at core people are concerned about is, in a sense, sort of the economics of the future. You know, what is my life going to be like? What opportunities
right. I also think one of the main things economists can contribute here is to push aside the perception of the inevitability of war. A lot of people, when they see a scenario like this with a lot of potential disruption, potentially people unhappy and a conflict, and they think inevitably war, and so they set aside sort of economic concepts and they want to talk about, well, whose side am I going to be on and when's the fight and how do I get my knife in early.
The classic between the machines and the people and that kind of stuff. I it's funny, being so far removed, I'm sure people will be disappointed. It didn't even occur to me to think about the inevitable war that might come along and to address that concern. But I doubt we'll have too much time to think about why that's wrong, and even though it is quite pervasive in all these technologies you see about AI are about us, or these science fiction novels, so many of the ones that get popularized are about us going to war against artificial intelligence, or artificial intelligence contributing between the war between human beings.
Right.
We should probably, I think, you know, we're 8 over now. We should probably more or less end it here.
Let's wrap up and say it was fun talking to you, Carl. I enjoyed this. Love to do it again.
Yeah, I'd love to do it again, too.